My name is Irene Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast Neue Musik Leben. This is a German podcast, but so often and once in a while I have some very interesting English episodes for you. I have studied classical singing, but I sing lots and lots and lots of contemporary music. And if you would like to know more about me, please look at my website www.irenekurke.de. I will put this link in the show notes. In this podcast, there are all themes and topics around new and contemporary music. I share with you behind the scenes, insider knowledge, and I bring you the human beings closer to you. I'm cooperating with the NMZ. NMZ Neue Musikzeitung is one of the biggest German music papers. Today I have an interview for you with Heather O'Donnell. Heather O'Donnell is a pianist, teacher, and psychologist. And well, she's a very fantastic pianist, but there was a time in her life she had chronic pain. And out of that, she also started to study psychology. And how now she combines all of that and, how things changed in her life, she will talk with you about that in this interview today. This is Heather O'Donnell. Hello, Heather. Heather O'Donnell, it's so great to meet you here.
Welcome. Thank you, Irene.
Well, we're sitting in my apartment and I don't know if the listeners can hear it. We have some machine working next door, but so you know, it's all live and real.
Yes.
My first question for you is, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
I had studied piano very intensively as a kid, and by the time I reached my teenage years, I hit my first roadblock by way of a crisis of understanding what possible relevance it could have for a girl from New Jersey to be spending her time with Mozart. It seemed in the environment I was growing up in that classical music's predominant function was to express high achievement, and it seemed that it was ignoring the currents, the political, social, cultural currents of our time at that point. And being a classical musician seemed pompous, self-indulgent, opulent. I loved the music, there was no doubt about it, but assessing what my role in society was, I had a real difficult time understanding how to bridge that cognitive dissonance. And spending so much time working on octaves and trills just seemed frivolous. Mm-hmm. I was studying at Manhattan School of Music preparatory program at that time, and I'd sometimes go out into the city, skip a music theory class or two. And one day I wandered to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and found myself in the 20th century wing, where they have an absolutely gorgeous painting of Jackson Pollock. Mm. It's called Autumn Rhythm. And I had an epiphanal moment there where I was wondering, what's the musical equivalent to this painting? I don't know. What could possibly be going on in music that could had the same kind of energy and dynamic quality. And I went back to Manhattan School and I went to the library and there was an ancient music history encyclopedia. And I looked in it and I looked up modern music and I found that there's composers, Hindemith, mm-hmm. Schoenberg, Messiaen. And obviously these composers have nothing to do with Jackson Pollock, but it was the first step in understanding that there's a whole world of music history that was not presented as part of my training. And I went to my teacher and said I was interested in this, and she had no interest in it, and she didn't want to support it, and that made me even more interested in it because I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And so I finished my high school studies with her, and then I went on to college and I picked teachers like Stephen Jury and later Peter Serkin, who were known for being specialists in contemporary music.
Okay, so you were already hooked and then you made the right choices.
Ready to go, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Great. And what represents good new music for you?
It's really hard to answer that question in the abstract. So when I think about composers I appreciate, I can answer that, and I'm going to list some attributes of composers that I really love and leave it up to the listener to figure out which composer it is. I deeply appreciate music that embraces and reflects the complexities of lived experience. Music that can hold in itself a multitude of meanings that might seem paradoxical or contradictory in other contexts, but that fuse together in a way that on one hand expresses the personality of the composer, and on the other hand offers an insight into shared human experience. I tend to be drawn to outsiders, composers who often struggle to find a place within any given musical establishment. In new music, this is anyway an outsider music establishment, so we're a bunch of outsiders, but I'm particularly drawn to outsiders even within the new music scene. This is really a personal intuitive inclination. Many of my closest friends and colleagues would really fit that description of outsider status. Being an outsider, of course, there's so many difficulties associated with how to earn the daily bread and butter, how to support yourself and your family. But I think there's one quality of being an outsider that it brings a absolutely honest quality of vulnerability and openness into it. It has the potential of bringing that into the music making, and artistic freedom. And it's just difficult when you've mastered a system that you're working in to maintain that quality of openness and vulnerability. And especially when you're dependent on this system for continuing your work. So that's why I tend to be really drawn to people who are finding their way outside the establishment.
Yeah, that's always very interesting, because I also think that most of the interesting things happen that way, that you go your own thing. But I mean, sometimes it happens too that people who have been outsiders suddenly become part of the system or liked and wanted, and maybe that's then challenging for them to really keep true to themselves and not like be part of the establishment. Although on the other hand, they're maybe happy that they now can really do their work and they have the opportunities and the finances. And
certainly in terms of being able to live and survive as a musician, you don't want to romanticize too much
being an outsider.
It can be very difficult and lonely, and it's really certainly not to disparage people who have achieved success. But it is difficult when you're functioning very well within that system to maintain a high degree of authenticity.
What are the qualities you most appreciate in composers you are working with?
Similar to what I just said, I appreciate it when I can sense the person coming through the music, when there's a quality of openness and vulnerability in the process of creating music, and this obviously has nothing to do with cheap self-indulgence. I appreciate composers who work collaboratively, really collaboratively with performers, where the performers can participate in the process of creating the piece. I'm grateful for composers that transcend the transactional nature that can be part of the music business, where a composer delivers the piece to the performer delivers the performance, but instead where the humanity of the process remains intact. I appreciate composers who challenge performers to exceed their own limitations, but that don't break the bodies or the spirits of the performers they're working with, obviously.
Great. So you are a great pianist and you played all over the world, and then something has changed. Now we're arriving at the topic of this podcast. So what happened to you, and what are you now interested and focused in?
I had a pretty spectacular crash as a performer, and this really took place between the years of about 2003 to 2010. I was already experiencing a lot of joint pain as a teenager and as a student throughout my studies. When my professional work took off, it was accompanied by almost constant joint and muscle pain, and often with very strange and unsettling sensations like weakness and tingling in the fingers and a lack of fine control. At the worst point in this struggle, around 2007, there was a partial atrophy in the right hand musculature. My left hand fourth finger trembled uncontrollably when any weight was placed on it. And I really didn't have an idea if I could make it through a performance because I couldn't feel my fingers.
But you just said that it already started quite early on? Why did you keep going?
Good question.
I mean,
I wonder myself that there were a couple decades invested in that, and then it blossomed to full extent in the mid-noughts. Mm. But that's a question I continue to ask myself. I had signals from the early 90s, mm-hmm. and just kept going, thinking that I would find a solution for them. Stubbornness, pigheadedness.
You love the music too much.
Determining.
I don't know.
I mean,
I have two things I have to think of when we're talking about that. The one thing is, I taught that once in a speech I gave on stage fright. When I was young, I actually also wanted to become a pianist.
Mm.
But for me it was, but really early on when I had to perform, my hands were really shaking. Uh-huh. And my teacher was amazed that I still would hit many right keys.
Right.
But I realized, this is wrong. Yeah. I cannot be a pianist. And then I realized when I was singing, performing with my voice, it could be that my knees are shaking, but my voice was always on.
Oh, really?
And so that was easy. On the other hand, I remember now a pianist who I knew from my school time, and we were performing during school and in our early studies. And when she started studying the piano, she also got problems with her hands.
Mm-hmm.
And her career also went a totally different route, because mm-hmm. she was at the Hochschule, they had many things offered, and then she actually started singing,
mm.
but more like chanson singing, mm-hmm. and now she has become like a pretty good like cabaretist, mm. or comedian,
yeah.
And sometimes she includes the piano a little bit,
yeah.
But it was also, and she's now very happy, but it was also like the hands were telling her
something,
and well, let's go on with your story and what you figured out.
Well, it's a really essential question, because I kept going. It was, for other people, I think these kind of difficulties show up more clearly. And mine were sometimes under the radar, especially in the early 90s, mid-90s. They would flare up and then get better, flare up, then get better. And there was never a clear enough indication to really change course. But I think you're right in suggesting mm-hmm. that there are signals. That. Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing. I mean, I know how many great things you did and played, and that you could still do it despite those symptoms.
It got progressively worse.
Yeah.
And in 2008, it was one hint of perhaps a clue to what was going on was that I had to be hospitalized because of extremely low blood levels. I was extremely anemic, and they did a battery of tests and they discovered an autoimmune disease. I'm really reluctant to say that the autoimmune disease is the cause of any pianistic problems. I think it was a contributor, but I did spend a couple years trying to understand or trying to explain it to myself. That was the cause of my pianistic problems. In hindsight, I think that's a route that only leads to frustration, because it's much too complicated. These difficulties that we experience in our health, it's going to be perpetually impossible for me to identify that the autoimmune disease caused my hand problems, or that the stresses I was experiencing as a musician caused the health problems. Mm. And the more time I spent on this, I noticed the more frustrated I would get. And I just have to live with the mystery. I think there's one benefit of that. Well, there's certainly one detriment of that, is that I can't go out into the public and say I had to give up my pianistic career because I had this illness. Mm-hmm. That would be a really nice sense of security and clear clarity. Mm-hmm. And that would offer a lot of a really nice reason. Mm. But what I do have is something in common with a lot of musicians I've been talking with. And there's very few people who have, when they encounter something which can change their career or perhaps end their career, very often it's not a very clearly diagnosable illness. It's a mixture of things. It's a very, very messy and intricate and complex mixture of all kinds of different things.
I mean, it's also the question what it really wants to tell you. Is it really that you have to stop it completely, or is it just a slight change of direction, whatever, repertory or something, or does it just reflect some whatever fears you should work mm-hmm. on, and then you can play happily. Mm-hmm.
That is
as ever. I mean, it's. I think that there can be so many different answers. Yeah,
that is the question. I remember when I was having all these mysterious joint pains. It wasn't able to be diagnosed with anything concrete. Doctors would mention the word psychosomatic, and for me at that point, when with my absolute limited understanding of what psychosomatic means, that was insulting. I thought they are telling me that the problems don't exist, that it's something that I'm making up, that I'm having mental health issues instead of physical health issues. Mm. And it was very hard for me to hear that. Having spent the last 10 years in psychology, it's clearer and clearer to me that there will always be a very strong mixture of psychological components that mm-hmm. feed into physical problems, especially as a musician, when your entire identity is wrapped yeah. up with the thing that you're doing, and where for many musicians it's really the only thing
it is that our identity, certainly.
It is your mm-hmm. identity. And so for a musician to experience physical pain and not have that be accompanied or preceded or succeeded by psychological pain, that would be, I think, impossible. Mm. I think it's always intertwined.
So when we go back to the crash, what happened then, and what are you now focusing on?
After I had the diagnosis, I thought, wow, that's wonderful. I can now treat that problem and become healthy again. And mm-hmm. I tried that for 2 years.
The autoimmune thing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I still had chronic pain. Chronic pain was so deeply wired into my system mm-hmm. that it was really not unrelenting. It wouldn't let go. And it was just not enjoyable to be a musician anymore. So I decided I could keep going. It was it wasn't a clear indication I have to stop mm-hmm, because my mm-hmm. hands are not functioning anymore. But there was such an enormous strain with the pain, with the insecurities, which got a little bit better after the diagnosis and changed health practices, but not enough to say I can spend the rest of my life doing this. Mm. So I started studying psychology at the Freie Universität in Berlin, and it's really a beginner's mind kind of thing. I was 35 and mm-hmm. sitting together with 18 and 19 mm-hmm. year olds. and a very humbling experience. I was approaching that project with a lot of the same kind of ambition and discipline that you get from being a musician, which can be helpful on the one hand, and on the other hand, keeps you in projects that might not be... your body might be sending you signals there mm-hmm. that say, maybe this is not the best thing for me to be doing. But I kept at it. I'm happy that I did, but it was not an easy transition mm-hmm. from being a musician to going and studying psychology. I think there would have been much more health promoting activities mm-hmm. that I could have done. Mm-hmm. But it's an infinitely interesting mm-hmm.
yeah,
subject.
Yeah, certainly.
When you take apart all the...
And did it help you to understand you better or what happened with you?
That's one of the side effects of studying psychology, mm-hmm. but it's always, always stressed mm-hmm. that if you're looking to solve your own psychological questions or issues, you shouldn't do it through a psychology mm-hmm, study mm-hmm. because you should do it through therapy.
Certainly.
psychology study is a lot of math. It's a mm-hmm. lot of natural science. It's a lot of experimental design.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it's a very stringent course of study. And I think the insights I'm getting, especially now that I'm in the later stages of a master's degree, are closer and closer to providing insights into my situation. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also just given me a wider ability to contextualize mm-hmm. what I was experiencing. When I was a musician, I was quite narrow because I was mm-hmm. a musician and
right.
nothing else. And now I have a little bit of an outsider mm-hmm. perspective on being a musician, which is very
helpful. And I mean, you're a musician and you studied psychology, and now mm-hmm. you're very... I mean, that's why we're talking here mm-hmm. today. Now you're very
yes.
interested in how you can help other musicians
exactly.
who... get in similar situations mm-hmm. or what we can do for so-called musical hygiene mm-hmm. or our mental health.
Yes.
This is now where you ended up.
Yes.
Cool.
This is my field at this moment. I'm working on several different paths. One of them is giving workshops. This past semester, I gave workshops at the Robert Schumann Hochschule in Düsseldorf. My function there is to present the complexities of health. I am not somebody who will promise an easy solution to entrenched health concerns. When people promise easy solutions, I tend to bristle, because for many years I was attracted to those easy solutions because they promised something which they ultimately couldn't provide. So I try to be very careful when I work with musicians in health issues, first of all, to make it a creative process. Thinking about health is really, really interesting. And I wish when I was healthy as a student, more or less, that I had understood that, that when you're working creatively with your health, it's as interesting as working creatively with music. There's so many fascinating things that go on in the body and go on in the mind. And when you start to think about them, it's a kind of discovery process, which is just fascinating. When you have to think about them because you're already injured or ill, then it can be tainted by a lot of anxiety, and it can be an unpleasant experience.
So what have you changed for yourself? And if you say you include thinking or working on health, I mean, are there certain practices or routines you
have
now in your day?
My practices, I do a lot of meditation. I shouldn't put it that way. I do some meditation. I try. I try to do meditation. Meditation is very, very helpful and has always been for me. Since I've been doing it, I am very, very aware of my physical health and nutrition and somatic practices that I do. I've engaged a lot with Feldenkrais and with Alexander. I'm certainly not a practitioner of these things, but I've been to decades, a decade of
Feldenkrais. So you watch lessons. Yourself, but you also keep yourself moving.
Exactly. And it's part of my daily.
Lots
daily.
Of the very basic things that everybody should do.
That everybody should do. I'm not an advocate for any certain, I'm not partisan about what practices people should be doing. I have a lot of respect for many, many different kinds of expressions of health. And I see it as a really fascinating process when you start to look into, for example, the writings of Feldenkrais and the practice of Feldenkrais. You start to see an awareness of a world that is so beneficial in anything you do, in music making, when you're healthy, when you're not healthy. It's so eye-opening, and I wish I had engaged much more with it in my student years.
So what have you learned, and what do you teach now musicians who have been hurt or sick when they come to you?
If I'm teaching pianists, we work at the piano, and we work on things that I've learned in my process. I wouldn't call it a method. It's drawing on a lot of different inputs from a lot of different people. Whether they're pianists themselves or whether they're physiotherapists or whether they're Alexander or Feldenkrais teachers. And I work with the individual who comes in. It's really important for me to stress, I don't apply a method onto somebody. When somebody comes to me with their problems, a lot of the process is diagnostic. So I apply some of the tools that I've learned throughout my psychology studies. We have to figure out what this individual has experienced, what this individual is experiencing now, what they bring into the lessons, what kind of preconceptions they have, what they've been told. So there's a lot of unraveling. There's a lot of time spent discussing problems. And the physical things we do at the instrument are very, very individualized. What's necessary? Where are they blocked? Where is there an overcompensation in some area? Where is there a lot of tension? So this is how I work with pianists. When I give workshops, they're focused more on health. I think there's a potential when you present injury and illnesses that it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy when you talk about the horrible nature of vocal dystonia and what can happen when you don't do this. And if you're not careful, you're going to wind up injured and it's going to all be horrible. Everything will fall apart. When you talk about this, people experience anxiety, and anxiety can have very concrete ways of working out on the system, and it can make pain, for example, can turn pain into a chronic condition. So I have to be very, very aware when I work with musicians of presenting a model of health which doesn't sweep the negative things under the carpet, but that doesn't thematicize them in a way that one becomes fixated on them. So you have to show what's possible and get people excited in the process. When I was 18, I just wanted to practice. When I'm working with 18-year-olds now, I try to show from the perspective of a musician who loves to practice. I love to spend time with the instrument. But how this kind of process can be as much of a process of self-discovery as spending this time in the practice room and discovering what the intricacies of the music that you're working in. And when you're working with your body as an instrument, then it becomes a really creative process, and that's very productive. I present a lot of information in my workshops. Pedagogically, I'm still not sure if that's a good way, but that's what I do because there is a lot of information to give, and it's all really interesting and exciting. And my hope is that the students take what they need at that point. They form a series of their own interventions that can help them at this moment. And then the other things they might store in some kind of part of their brain that might, when they have something happen 20 years from now, this little light in their brain might go off and say, I've heard about this situation and I have some tool how to address it.
I can relate to that. I mean, also when I look at my own singing, but also when I teach, that I really find, for me at least, there's this fine line. I mean, when somebody, you know, sings for me, I mean, I hear what I think is good and I hear what I'm like, okay, we should work on that. But I'm often not a teacher who names them, the things that are not working, but rather work on what is working, or I have my ways to transfer it, that they can do it. Because sometimes there is a power in knowing what maybe you're not good at yet. But on the other hand, I also have the feeling people get too fixated. And this is why I don't name certain things. Unless somebody really, really asked me, then I would do that. Because I'm often not sure if that's helpful. And oftentimes I also experience, and that I experience with myself too, that the things maybe I'm still struggling with, maybe already 10 people have told me. And then whatever, the 11th person comes and I'm like really frustrated because like, oh my God, I'm working on this for so long now and it's still there. And I often think that's maybe not helpful to really overcome it. And it's interesting because now you're talking about more the whole picture, the whole person, the health. But I feel, at least with singing, I mean, it's also the whole body I work with myself or with my students. It's the same thing. And I'm not a fan to just put the finger to the wound and make it worse. Or I don't know if it's also an old way of pedagogy. I don't do it as much, actually. Even though I realize what is wrong or not working yet.
There's immense value in people having the sense that they've discovered something themselves and haven't been told it and received it passively from somebody else. And I want to relate a story about a lot of colleagues and students that I've had contact with over the years. There's a narrative that I hear repeated over and over again. People who have an injury, they have a blockage, they have some situation in their lives where everything comes to pieces. They seek help in so many different directions. They go to 10 different doctors, 10 physiotherapists, all kinds of interventions. They get frustrated with these individual interventions and they sense it's not helping me. And eventually, the message that comes back is I had to figure out at the end my own solution. Yes. I had to heal myself. And I appreciate this story so much because I don't necessarily believe that the interventions were not helpful. I think they were part of the puzzle.
Yes.
But if you feel that you've been passively treated and that you haven't figured out the solution to your difficulty, it's never going to be satisfying. Mm-hmm. So to have this sense, I had to take all that information, sort it out. I had to go down a path where I might have spent 6 months going down what for me felt like a false way, then come back. That sense of personal responsibility and agency over the health issue is invaluable. Mm. And at the end, when people come and say, I solved it myself, I think that's a wonderful outcome.
Yeah, I think you have to make it your own in a way. And where I also find a parallel to singing or teaching singing. I mean, I have my way to teach singing and I have certain ideas how the body should be and how you involve it and use it. And sometimes, I mean, most of the times the students who come to me, they like the way I'm teaching. But one time I also had a person who was singing with, she was at a different teacher before, with lots of force. And that's not my way of teaching. So I kind of showed her, and then she, I think, said herself after two sessions, I'm not coming. And I'm like, okay, that's fine, because I knew she wants something different. I had another student, she was developing very, very well with me. And then she started working parallel, I think, with a person where she was working on her only her speaking. And I also had the feeling he was doing everything contradictory to my teaching. So I made her loose and relaxed. Everything was smooth and in flow. And when she came back, everything was stiff again because she was at this different teacher. So I watched it two times because I thought, okay, will she realize what I'm offering her? Will she maybe realize, oh, maybe it's even better to be relaxed? But she was in the struggle. And then I said to her, I'm like, you know what? You're doing something that's completely the opposite that what I'm teaching. This is a waste of time. You have to decide now which way you're going. And I'm a fan of, and that's something you just mentioned, go one road, go it really, go it 100%, even if you maybe realize yourself after a while, this is not a good road. But don't do this kind of mixing everything together. And so I said to her, I can support you, can come back anytime, but you now have to decide what you want to decide. I don't agree with what you're learning at this other person. And then she actually decided to stick with this other person, but we were still in friendly touch. And it was interesting because I think after 6 or 7 months, she changed again. And then she went to another teacher where I know that his style is even more relaxing than mine. So I realized, okay, she also went that road, but obviously also realized herself, okay, this is not a good way, and changed. And I think that's very valuable. We always were in good touch because I'm a person who also lets students go, you know, if they have to make this experience, so what? And yeah, that what just came to my mind when you said, okay, it's sometimes good to really dig into one direction and either you take something out of it or you realize yourself and then this self-realization is so powerful.
It's so powerful. I remember so strongly in the process of trying to figure out what kind of therapy, whether it was a medical intervention, whether it was sometimes questions about surgery, very alternative methods, crazily alternative methods. I experimented and played with so many different things. There is a certain degree of comfort when you encounter somebody who's offering a clear solution to a problem. At the end of my struggles with all of this maze of interventions, I became really allergic to people offering very clean-cut solutions. There may be easy solutions, but in my experience, I've never encountered one. So, for example, if somebody is struggling with a high degree of tension in playing and somebody offers to apply a certain method in order to take away that tension, first of all, you're not understanding why the tension was there in the first place, what the tension was telling the musician. The tension can have a function, can be part of a compensation program that the body is trying to work with. And if you have overly simplistic solutions to these things through a very clearly delineated method, I think it may give you a sense of satisfaction in the short term, but in my experience, it's never been a long-term help.
I have two thoughts about that. And one thing is with this cold, easy solution. I think it also depends where you are on your road. Maybe already you went this far and has discovered and integrated and included, and then maybe there comes a so-called easy solution, and maybe that's it, and you're through this process.
Right.
The other thing, what you said with tension, I mean, I know that too. We singers also work on releasing tensions, and I also tried Alexander technique, and I don't know if it was just not a match or the teachers didn't match, and then they often would just say, you know, be relaxed, release your tension, and it made me just mad because
you get more tense.
I was more tense because I'm like, I know I should release tension, but how do I do that?
Yeah.
They didn't tell me. And on the other hand, with Feldenkrais, I made very good experiences because for me, obviously, through, you know, doing movements, I could experience it somehow. And I mean, so I know that sometimes if somebody said, yeah, just release your tension, I'm like, how do I do that?
Yeah.
And then I was really aggressive.
The stereotype of a teacher standing over a student saying, relax! And this is the absolute most unrelaxing thing that you can listen. And of course, with everything you do, piano playing, singing, there's room for everything. There's room for tension. There's room for relaxation. There's room for every physiological manifestation of the musical or communicative thing that you're trying to work with. And it's a question very often of balance and of flow and free. So when people are talking exclusively in terms of relaxation, that's very often just not a whole picture because relaxation has to come from something. It has to come from engagement that can be relaxed. And when it's a chronic engagement, when it's a tension, then it can be problematic. But very often when I talk about these things, it's hard to clarify what it is that we're working on in the abstract, because it's so contingent on any given situation. And I think for me, it's a real branding problem, because I appreciate and place so much value on the individuality of the process that it would really cheapen it to say, this process of getting through injuries, maintaining health, increasing health, is infused with this and this and this method. That seems always so reductive and so such a poor reflection of what the process actually is. I think we suffer from the fact that we treat illnesses and injuries as objects. I have focal dystonia. Focal dystonia is a process. You work through it. At the end, it's not that you have overcome it and you can throw this object in the trash anymore. For the rest of your life, you're going to be living as a survivor of focal dystonia, so to say. And you're going to have a different approach to music making after that. And that's not necessarily negative. It can be actually really positive. But this whole process, I appreciate so much the individuality of the process, the nature that you come encounter with somebody and you work with them and you work through the specific things that they're indicating to you, where they need somebody to come in, where they might need somebody to provide resistance against, where they might need somebody to be a bouncing board just for ideas, where you need to stay quiet as a pedagogue or as a psychologist, where you might just let people try out things and just be there to absorb it, where you might have to really intervene and say, this is dangerous what you're doing, where you might have to say, I have transcended my area where I can help and I have to send this person on to somebody else. These are all the kind of daily questions that arise, and it's a process which doesn't lend itself to easy categorizations. You have to see it as it is, a very, very complex and infinitely interesting.
I know that you're playing piano again, or and how is your playing now changed, or your performing, or your preparation?
I am having so much fun.
Great!
I practice, which people who knew me before, I was a compulsive practice, so that was one of my problems. Mm-hmm. I was a stupid practicer. I can really give myself that little slap on the cheek, light, friendly slap on the cheek. But when I couldn't identify what was going wrong in my playing, I overcompensated through over practicing, and that was, as you say in German, a Teufelskreis,
a
devil's circle. That it just fueled into the problems, this over practicing. So now I practice most an hour a day. I have so much fun when I do it, and for the first time in decades, really since I was a teenager, I don't have pain. And I want to make sure, I don't want to stress this as kind of I've overcome this, because I think these narratives that people give, I overcame my problem. I think that is more harmful than it is helpful in the most cases, because I don't want to present an end point. This is an ongoing process for me of checking in and seeing where I am and what I can do and how much I can do and how little I can do. At this point, I'm immensely enjoying not having pain when practicing. It's just a whole different quality of playing. And I'm immensely enjoying the big, beefy pieces, which are so much fun to play and which make being a pianist just the most wonderful thing in the world. And so it's been a lot of fun to come back. And I really, I say this very, very earnestly. I don't, In our culture, the hero story is a model which is too often thrown away, and this is nothing about like overcoming and at the end standing there a hero. This is about being extremely humbled by life's difficulties and being really honest with myself about all the things that I put into this, which might have made my path so much more difficult than it needed to be. It's a lot of self-reflection. It's a lot of growth. And it's certainly not the end of it. It's certainly not like, I overcame this problem. And I want to just put that out there because...
But that also makes it exciting and alive that you're still discovering and seeing, and how do I feel tomorrow or how do I feel in 3 weeks. I mean, even though this is a very complex and broad topic, are there any tips you would like to give musicians for their mental and physical health in this podcast?
To address the problems when, or let me put it a different way, to address issues like health as a counterpart of the kind of musical creativity they're engaging in. If musicians are playing with their music and playing with their health and with the same kind of openness and creativity and enjoyment, then there's a really great chance of maintaining health throughout the lifespan. Every single person will have moments in their lives where their bodies present problems or are screaming at them and saying, please do something, please help me. Every single person will have psychological issues in their life, whether it shows in a form of depression or burnout or anxiety. And during these periods, it may not be easy to maintain that kind of playful relationship to these questions. They may become very serious and very much infused with anxiety. We need to practice when we're healthy so that when we may not be healthy, we have something to fall back on. We've established a practice. And you don't want to wait until you're not healthy in order to start thinking about health. Because it's difficult.
That's the harder way, I assume.
Not impossible.
I mean, then you're really pushed or forced to, but it's probably harder.
It's much more difficult. And it's times in life which, if you can build up through practice something when you're in the good times of life that will assist you in the times that are not so good, you will help yourself immensely. And yet, none of us want to live in fear or in anxiety that something will crash. And that's why I think the enjoyment factor, the looking for interest. If somebody's not motivated or interested in this kind of somatic education, whether it's yoga or Tai Chi or whatever, if it's out of a sense of obligation or just that, oh, I should do this in order, find something else. There's so many different things. It could be ballroom dancing, whatever. It could be anything that will infuse this kind of lightness and enjoyment factor. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are, from my vantage point as now somebody who is working in psychology, a psychologist, there's so much that happens when you're engaging with something not out of a sense of obligation, mm-hmm. not out of a sense of I must do this, this is yet another thing my teacher tells me I have to practice this mm-hmm. amount of, I have to do this, I have to do this, and yet I have to do my health thing.
Mm-hmm.
physically, there's so much, you know, in the neuronal area, there's so much that happens that make that not a very productive process.
Yeah.
When any of these processes, whether they're music making, whether they're health maintenance, is accompanied by fascination, by real aliveness, by a sense of curiosity, and everything but a sense of just dread and obligation, it's a much, much more, it's a better way.
You mentioned before that you're also now teaching or lecturing at the Robert Schumann Musikhochschule. What exactly are you teaching there, and what is the content of your workshops?
This past semester, I gave two workshops in musicians' health. One was very wide concept of musicians' health, addressing four areas: psychological health, physical health, social health, which is a very interesting topic. And the fourth one is a little bit, in German you say umstritten, a little bit contentious, but it's a new model of health, and it's called spiritual health.
Oh, good.
I say this with a remembrance of myself at 18, and I would think, oh, God, what's that? That sounds really loopy. The thing that spiritual health addresses is that people are working in a way in which they sense meaning in their life. That's really what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that meaning is associated with any given religion or whether it's associated with the sense that I'm providing something good to society, that's up to the individual to determine. But having this kind of spiritual health is an absolutely necessary component of health. And it's something especially in the most dire situations when you're really struggling. That will be something, again, it's a practice that you establish in healthy times that will get you through very, very difficult times. So what I did with the students in this Musician's Health course was presented an awful lot of information in a way that I thought the most could come through. So as we spoke before, me standing up and lecturing at them is probably the least effective way. So we did a lot of exercises. We did a lot of self-exploration and writing. And I put information out there that they could seek according to what they needed at that moment, what was most relevant. It was a fantastic weekend. I had a small group of musicians. They were so open. They were so honest about the struggles they have. I remember when I was studying, there was really a strong taboo about speaking openly about health issues and certainly about injuries. We could really talk about pretty personal things. And I was very appreciative of their honesty and of their openness. And it was a good weekend.
Great.
The other thing that was worked on was practicing techniques. And with practicing techniques, I try to adopt a kind of Feldenkraisian approach where I'm not prescribing a certain method that they should use. They get so much of that in their daily life anyway.
Certainly.
But I'm presenting a lot of a wide repertoire of possibilities. They could be mental practicing, could be thinking about visualization techniques in imagining performance situations. It can be learning about the different modalities of practicing the kind of physical memory capabilities as opposed to oral memory, as opposed to kind of formal memory, these kind of things, feedback loops, neuronal feedback loops. So presenting options so that they can start to think, what do I need? What works for me? What can I carve out? Again, a creative, individualized process. The last thing I want to do is be yet another person that comes and applies something on top of these poor people. I remember being a music student, you have to put your body on this way on the piano. You have to contort yourself into this style of music. You're getting so much information from so many different sources of how you should be. And there's very little opportunity to ask yourself, what actually do I need? What do I want to do now? What would be the best thing for me to do right now? And if I can help with that internal dialogue, that's where I see a big part of my function.
Great. We will also put the information to you and your website into the show notes, that who wants help from you or who wants to invite you for a workshop can contact you. Thank you so much about talking health and how we musicians should treat our health. And actually, we now arrived at the last question. And this is, which tip would you like to give young artists?
It's human nature when you're young to think that you have infinite resources of energy, of health, of physical capabilities. It's at this point where you're also training things that could help you for the rest of your life. You have an opportunity when you're young to explore things in a way that when you get older, you have a lot more responsibilities. You don't really have as much time and as much resources to be as open and receptive to new ideas. And that's just a structural thing about middle age. It's having families and all kinds of things that take your mind off of the things like health and artistic creation and things like this. When you're young, find aspects of this that you can engage with in terms of your health. As I said before, there's so many interesting things. It doesn't have to be boring. It doesn't have to be a burden. There's so many interesting things, and it helps not only in terms of avoiding injury and avoiding illness, but in terms of making you much more able to communicate, much more able to have a richness in your music making. It expands your capabilities. And this is the secret that I wish somebody had told me, whispered to me when I was a kid and just practicing over and over again for many, many hours a day.
Well, thank you so much, Heather, that you took your time for this interview with me.
My pleasure.
And that we now talked about your second career. I mean, you're still a pianist, but now you also
have... strange hybrid creature I am.
other great things to give. I thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Elena. It's great to be here.
This was the interview with Heather O'Donnell. I really hope that you could take a lot out of it. And I'm welcoming you to write me with ideas, suggestions. You can write me through email or Facebook. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really hope that you liked it and it inspired you. And I'm looking forward if you would like to recommend this podcast to your friends and colleagues. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.